Council Harrington will be here in just a second, so I'm going to convene the meeting of council work session for September 19th. And first order of business is Chief Operating Officer Communication.
So I apologize for being late. I got thrown off by the fact that employee service coordinations of the convention center and like the rest of the day. It was a great lunch.
That food was good.
It was good, and the stories were good.
Yes.
As always, I have three items. First is, I hope you saw the email from Matt Cora about Farrow's Fibers as of last week. They are no longer accepting mixed plastics, bulky rigid plastics or plastic bags. I think we have all of this spoken up here, so do you have anything you want to say about products? I need to put it on the spot, but I will.
I think I'd rather respond.
So I know you're going to get questions from folks when you're out and about this, and I guess, you know, essentially they've made the changes about because of their ability to send the materials to market. But I'd be happy to offer to you that if you write down what people are asking about, we'll do our best to get them information.
I think there's an opportunity here, a sad opportunity, but an opportunity nonetheless, that the way the system works, the whole ecosystem, is essentially we're collecting these materials and then getting them to a private market. And that's part of what the comments I'm getting from various community members is, what do you mean I can't keep taking these things, right? And it's all because of changes in the private market. So I think there's an opportunity for us to just get some, you know, outreach messages, news feed or whatever, to remind folks that this is how the ecosystem works. And we're a party to it, but we don't get to control it. So, you know, they don't need, I say this because of the community concern that was expressed to me at Metro about the closure of the Far West Fibers Beaverton site. And so this only scales it up more. So that's where I'm coming from.
I guess the other thing I just remind you of is that you gave us all direction to reinvigorate an old program we used to have on the books to refresh it because it really didn't work originally the way it was supposed to try to develop markets for some of these products, and so we're going to be coming back to you later this year to talk to you about that program and sort of how we can update and refresh it. So I think on the council rollout for October's turning out to be the Hinky month. That's another topic.
So you're asking if we have any questions about Far West Fiber to
write it down. We're asking to answer them. If we can't, we'll of course help if we can. But also just remember that we're trying to also figure out how can we innovate in this marketplace so that there is some
resolution. So my problem is I haven't received a question I can't answer, but rather I have folks in the community who are trying to. And you know, we have to. I'm asking that the agency consider scaling it up from these individual conversations to. There's an opportunity for us to communicate and push something out more broadly.
Okay.
Martha, can I just address that? Yeah. There'll be a meeting going out by about 5:00.
Great. Thank you. Good to hear.
I only wish we could now claim it was in response to council direction, but it's not. Like that would be
proactive is better. Proactive is better.
Well, the second thing is, I think you all know that the evacuation orders from Multnomah County were lifted because it's raining, and so we were able to reopen Oxbow Park today. I want to thank Parks and Nature staff for all the work that they did at both Oxbow and Blue Lake, because we also had some impromptu closures of Blue Lake when we had smoke so bad that we noticed that we had guests that were actually having trouble breathing, so close to the park. They've been really flexible. I also know that they're working on efforts to address some of the concerns of some of the neighbors of Oxbow about what happened during this most recent event and what's happening globally. So we'll be working with Councilor Craddock to sort of talk to the neighbors about what's going on there and let you all know the results of this conversation. And then I think you all also know that I-84 did reopen westbound, but it's not open eastbound. And we are ODOT is not giving us a time estimate about when they plan to reopen. I know they've got concerns not only about hazard trees, but also about the effect of the rain on soil conditions. Mm-hmm. Mudslides, yeah. I've had the opportunity to delivering those things in the gorge. So I know that's a concern. So we are working, obviously, Paul's here, so he can answer. My note says measurements at Lowe's to Quaker Ridge. We've also sent Lowe's to Coffin Dew, Hillsboro, Coffin Counts, and Harry Landfills during the closure. Obviously, we'll go back to normal when the freeway reopens. If you have questions about that, Paul's here.
Just in time for ice.
Just in time for ice. I hope we have a couple of months between smoking ice. And then the last thing I have is I know Ernie sent out to you earlier today a draft of a letter that we'd like your approval of to send to the City of Portland, commenting on their implementation of the affordable housing bond program. So I think it's in front of you. So Chase, is there anything you want to say? I want to thank Emily and Alyssa Gertler for being thoughtful about making sure that Metro articulated the regional policies that you all have set around this issue in this draft, but I don't know if
that's what you're saying. Well, I just would say our staff have been, you know, really engaged in the process and participating in the committee that has been providing input along the way on this. I think it's really important that the city get this right as a model for future, you know, projects and opportunities throughout the region, and showing that they can do it well and do it effectively. So I appreciate the staff spending the time and energy on it, and the opportunity to weigh in and encourage the city to move forward.
So we're looking for a thumbs up.
I have a question. I'm not familiar with the constitutional limitations of a general obligation bond regarding affordable housing. And I assume if the city has it, we might have a challenge.
But also, I'm not sure what you're referring to. This refers to the item from MPAC that I sent you a request on.
You know, I'm not familiar with recalling exactly which kinds of financing it is hard to, and difficult to get. So when bonding happens from a public entity, then the financing available through federal avenues, there's 4% and 9%, which is different structures. And so if you can't access those, in particular some of the non-competitive ones that you want to bring in just to bring in more money, then that makes it very difficult to make these projects work and leverage other dollars. So it's looking for an opportunity to leverage other resources and be able to bring in other federal.
I think that you're both, between you, it's about how can you use geo bond funds in cooperation with nonprofit, privately owned nonprofit housing providers.
And federal
still
tax credits.
The limitations on the expenditures. It's about marrying different sources of money and different kinds of housing providers.
Yep.
It is the limitation of the city's wrestling with.
Yep.
And I'm not smart on the actual nuances of the Constitution letters on geo bonds, but I do know matching geo bond money with other kinds of money is really hard.
And just to follow up, so the state legislature could change that.
They have to go to the voters. So they have to go to the voters.
We'll dial that to be more accurate.
Because this would be something that we would be need to consider too as a region.
Yeah, I believe that Andy and Aaron talked to Chris briefly at a very high level when they were here earlier. So
they're pretty well steeped in it.
Okay.
Did you feel like you got the thumbs up?
I didn't hear anything.
I got the memo landed in our inboxes at 12:16, so this is the first I heard about it. I know I can read it between now and the end of the meeting, so if we could come back to it, that would be awesome.
True.
Thank you.
And I also know that the second bullet has some grammatical things. Okay, I'm done.
Cool. Thank you. First, the work session topic says material recovery facility conversion technology project update.
Good afternoon, councilors, council president Hughes. I'm Paul Slyman, your director of property and environmental services. Today's work session is a continuation of our discussion about the potential regulation and oversight of material recovery and conversion technology facilities. I have with me today Dan Blue. Dan is the senior planner within Metro Solid Waste Information Compliance and Cleanup Group. He's been with Metro for almost 2 years now, and prior to that, he was the solid waste manager for the city of Gresham for 8 years. Dan will be reviewing with you proposed amendments to Metro Code Title 5, Chapters 500 and 501 related to licensing and oversight of certain material recovery and conversion technology facilities that receive source-separated recyclable materials. Dan will also provide an overview of the extensive public engagement process used to get us to this point. This process involved industry, local government, and other members of the public. Today, we're seeking your direction on whether to bring the proposed code changes to you for formal consideration next month. First, I'd like to offer a brief reminder. Under state law and independent home rule charter, Metro has broad authority and responsibility for planning, managing, and overseeing the regional solid waste system. We manage the region's solid waste system on behalf of the public for the purposes of protecting people's health and the environment, getting good value for the public's money, ensuring the highest and best use of materials, being adaptable and responsive in managing materials, and ensuring services are available to all types of customers. The issues before you today are in keeping with those responsibilities. As you are aware, Metro Council has determined that we should actively manage the system in a variety of ways, including owning and operating facilities, conducting long-range planning and implementing programs for the future of the system, cleaning up illegal dumps, authorizing, inspecting, and overseeing private facilities through inspections, site visits, and establishing conditions of authorization, and much, much more. It's this last bullet that's the primary focus of our discussion with you today. In October 2015, we sought your guidance on addressing major needed changes to Metro Solid Waste Code called Title V. At the time, we had a variety of important changes we were seeking, yet stakeholders voiced concerns that our process had not sufficiently included them. So we slowed down, we proposed a comprehensive approach, and we separated our work into three tracks. You go back one slide. So track one, that's the topic of today. It relates to public trust in the system and a level playing field. Track two includes the fee and tax exemptions on solid waste. Tim Collier and Warren Johnson have been working on that. And track three was the topic of housekeeping improvements, which became effective in February, hence the big green check mark. So now you go to the... So you agreed with this approach, and you directed staff to pursue the three separate code tracks and restart public engagement and review for each of them. As a result of your direction, we launched an extensive engagement process culminating in a set of recommendations that we brought to you back in January. That is the green box, fake green box, right? I didn't go there. There. So we've now made it all the way to this yellow box. That's about mile 13.1, and we're about to turn the corner. And that's what we're going to discuss with you in just a minute. So going back to the previous graph, so the next slide. Yes, thanks. So today we're focused on discussing facility oversight under track one. This track really asks if Metro should exercise more oversight at facilities that process curbside recyclables or convert solid waste into energy, fuel, or other products. So it's possible that you're looking at that graphic and you listen to me talk, and much like our practice audience, are still saying, what's a MRF and what's conversion technology? So brief explanation. So we used to call them clean MRFs. We now refer to them as source-separated recyclable, source-separated material recovery facilities. And I'll describe it this way. Depending upon where you live in our region, you might roll up to three different carts to your curb each week. The colors change throughout the region, but I think you know how the carts behave. You roll one cart, it contains garbage that gets sent to a transfer station and eventually to a landfill. You know an awful lot about that process, quite too much about that process. You might roll a second cart, it contains yard debris. In some parts of the region, it contains yard debris and food scraps. That cart is managed and taken to a compost facility. And there are compost facilities around the region that process that and make a tremendous finished product. You probably roll a third cart that contains these source-separated recyclables. That goes to a clean or source-separated material recovery facility or a sorting facility. It's this last roll cart that Dan has been working on for the past year. The first two are already part of our regulatory system, and you hear from owners of such facilities. It's this last roll cart that we believe we need to get involved with. A key component of regulating solid waste facilities is to have clear, resilient, and responsive rules. I appreciate Martha mentioning that Korot's email last Friday. That's a good example about significant system disruptions where we believe, for a variety of reasons, we need to be involved in that aspect of the system. It allows us to be part of the solution to significant system disruptions and know more about what's going on in these facilities. The second category up here, CT, conversion technologies, is much easier. While the definition in the proposed chapters is very complicated, in simple terms, we're really talking about creating a transparent and bright line between facilities that accept materials as an ore and a manufacturing product versus facilities that accept unsorted, potentially recyclable materials and process them, and then they start to look much more like a waste sorting or a waste management facility. We hope that we can draw this predictable, clear line so such businesses can operate and thrive. So thanks for allowing time for the brief introductory comments. Dan will provide an overview of the proposed code amendments and the results of our public engagement process. Dan?
Thanks, Paul. Good afternoon, counselors. Thanks for giving me a little bit of your time today. Paul did a great job of introducing it. A little bit of what I'm going to say might be a little bit of a repeat, so bear with me. It is a relatively short presentation. So I have a brief presentation today that will cover the following. I'll go over the stakeholder engagement process that we followed for this project in a little bit more detail than Paul did. I'll review the proposed code changes that are contained in your packet, as well as provide a high-level overview of the public comments that we received on those proposed changes. Finally, we'll seek your input and support for proceeding forward with this project. So as Paul mentioned, a reminder that the purpose of the MERCT project is to consider whether facilities that process source-separate recyclables should be subject to licensing, inspection, and reporting similar to other solid waste facilities. Paul did a great job introducing that. Thank you. So a little bit just quickly back to this process that we followed. In October of 2015, you directed staff to initiate a more robust policy review process that included multiple engagements with SWAC, with council, with industry, local governments, and the general public. So we responded to your direction and formed the MERCT subcommittee in December of 2015. The subcommittee met 7 times throughout 2016, resulting in a set of recommendations that were reviewed and endorsed by SWAC, as well as you. We shared those recommendations with you in January, and at that time you directed us to proceed with the project, including that we should draft code amendments and a set of administrative rules that implemented the recommendations of SWAC and the subcommittee. So we did that work. We put the draft documents out for a 60-day public comment period. We held 2 stakeholder workshops attended primarily by industry and local government representatives to review the proposed code changes and the draft administrative rules. And finally, we reviewed the results of the public comment period and stakeholder workshops with SWAC on August 9th, just recently. So SWAC provided some feedback and then endorsed having us bring the proposed code changes to you for consideration, which is, again, why we're here today. So let's see. We're at that. And as Paul said, that yellow box on the top right of the screen. Okay, so let's move on to the proposed code changes. Metro Code Title 5, Chapter 500 contains the definitions that apply to the rest of the chapters in that section of code. The changes in 500 related to this project are minimal and include only adding definitions for the terms conversion technology and specific material recycler. The conversion technology definition matches verbatim the state's definition. That's that really lengthy definition that Paul is referring to. Specific material recycler is a new designation that refers to facilities that receive and process a single type of material, such as plastics or metals, but do not receive those materials directly from curbside generators through a regulated collection program. That green card, or the blue card that Paul refers to earlier. Both of those definitions are contained in your council packet. So, now moving to the changes for 501. This chapter is our facility regulation chapter, and this is where the original exemption for this type of facility resides. The changes necessary to implement the recommendations for 501 are still also pretty brief. The proposed code changes removes the current exemption for source-separated recyclable material recovery facilities and establishes new exemptions for specific material recyclers and certain conversion technology facilities that exclusively receive non-compostable waste as a feedstock. That's it. Oh, and then a little bit of housekeeping as well. So again, specific wording on the proposed changes is included in your packet. So I'd like to move now on to a high-level review of what we heard from the public and stakeholders during the public comment period. Okay. As I mentioned, we put the code changes and draft rules out for a 60-day public comment period, which closed July 14th. We held two stakeholder workshops to go over the code changes, as well as a very draft set of administrative rules, should the code amendments be adopted by council. The stakeholder workshops included representation from the majority of the MRF operators in the region, as well as representation from Agilex, our only conversion technology facility in the region. We received very little feedback on the proposed code changes during those workshops, but a tremendous amount of useful feedback on the draft administrative rules. Today, again, we're only focusing on the proposed code changes, not the administrative rules at this point. So the feedback we did receive related to code changes came from three industry stakeholders. Two of the three commenters commended the expanded stakeholder engagement process that we used. They appreciated the opportunity to provide input on the proposed code changes and provided constructive suggestions for improving the language of the proposed amendments to the code. One commenter expressed a range of criticisms related to the process generally. Question to Metro's legal authority to regulate this sector of the industry, has concerns that regulation could negatively impact their business, and are generally in opposition to ending the exemption from licensing for source-separated recyclable material recovery facilities. So that's one of the three sets of comments that we received. This is in contrast to the majority of industry representatives who participated in the engagement process. All of the detailed comments that we received, as well as staff responses to those comments, are also in your packet. I think there's about 13 pages of them. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have regarding the public comments that we received at the end of the presentation. So should council provide direction to us to proceed with bringing an ordinance forward to amend chapters 500 and 501, we would come back to your business meeting on October 5th with an ordinance to accomplish that. And then a second read would be on October 26th. The license requirement would not come into effect for existing or any new facilities that may come online until January 1st, 2019. So there's a lot of time to implement any changes to come in compliance with the license. Assuming council adopted the changes, we would then follow the administrative rule adoption process, which is currently outlined in code, to adopt rules for those facilities that would be required to obtain a license. That would include an additional public comment period and a public hearing before adoption took place. So that concludes my presentation. Thanks for your time. I'll be happy to answer any questions you have about what I presented before we get to these questions.
Questions? Any questions? Go ahead, Kathy.
I'm afraid I allowed myself to get confused. So with curbside recycling, I wrote down that that's now considered source separated. The companies that take the materials from the haulers, are considered source separated material recovery facilities.
Yeah, let me clarify. Those have always been considered source separated recyclables, and we've always loosely referred to facilities or processed those as MRFs. We're trying to just specify that particular type of facility from those MRFs that receive dry waste like CMB and sort that material out.
Well, I have a question about that later. Okay.
May I make a quick comment on that? We used to call them clean MRFs.
Yes.
Then the others were automatically considered dirty MRFs. And it's not really fair to them to call them dirty MRFs. So.
But where I got tripped up was on, let's see, page 8 of the chapter 5.0, the new part. Specific material recycler means a facility that processes a single type of non-petrescible recyclable material that holds intrinsic value. So these companies that receive this commingled material, it's not a single type of non.
Yes.
Because it's commingled.
So the specific material recycler is a new classification of facility that we are setting aside, continuing to provide an exemption for them because they are not receiving the curbside recyclables from the blue cart from commercial or residential regulated collection programs.
So they're the recycler, they're not the MRF. Got it. They receive materials.
They're a little bit of both. They receive material, though, not directly from the curb. They may receive it from a business directly, and it tends to be a single type of material. Denton plastics is a good example. Schnitzer steel is another example.
Yeah.
We want to distinguish them from those facilities that receive that curbside material.
Yep, that works for me. Got it. So then I had another question on the material. When I went on to read the chapter 5.01 and on, I followed page 4, on pages, on page 19, so section 5.01.260, obligations and limitations for selected types of activities. The section that was struck about the must recover at least 25% by weight of non-petrescible waste, that whole section related to, I thought, dry MRFs and our previous work on that. So I'm trying to figure out, wait a second, why did all of a sudden all that work that we did on dry MRFs and all that work going from back door standards to front door standards and all that, why is that gone all of a sudden?
I may have to ask Warren to help me with this, but let me take a stab at it. This was part of the housekeeping, updating the section of code, because the 25% requirement went away, unless Warren has something different to say.
Excuse me, there's a copy of it. So this section that you're referring to, this is a placeholder. When we adopted the Enhanced Dry Waste Recovery Program, there was a new recovery standard that was put in place. This 25%, the Edward replaced this 25%, so that's not being used, it's not applicable to the facilities currently.
Okay, so that strike through has nothing to do with MRF / CT.
Correct. Is that one of the housekeeping changes? Yes.
Thank you. That, because the diagram before told me all that housekeeping stuff was already done. Okay, so I'm doing okay. I'm okay with it being struck out. I get that timing of it. You know, it's there. It's still there. We need to clean it out. But I didn't need to relate those two things. And
the only thing that does relate to MRF CT is just above that, notwithstanding.
Yep, I got that part. That wasn't my...
Good.
Yes. Thank you.
Sure.
That's regrettable.
I mean, maybe you should have asked Keith this beforehand, but I'm so hung up on the purpose of this, the value of this to the region, that we make these code changes. So what is going to be different that's not occurring right now because of these code changes?
Well, if you're a conversion technology facility, you have a big question if whether Metro is going to regulate you or not. When the Agilis technology was set up under the Waste Tech name at a facility that is in operation for maybe a year or so. We actually regulated them as a waste-related facility. I don't know to them that was of merit or abundantly clear, but it was ambiguous to us whether they were receiving, you know, what you might consider a spec raw material for ore, or whether you were receiving sort of waste of a sort. And so at the time, we said, as long as you're receiving waste that requires some sort of sorting or management, we're considering you a waste facility. Not much came to pass because their facility closed after a short period of time, but we'd like to provide more predictability to those facilities in the future, and that's why Agilis was very active in this conversation. A couple other reasons regarding the source of separated material recovery facilities, so separate from the conversion technologies. One is that public trust element. So members of the public really are quite surprised when they find out that of the number of roll carts they bring to the curb, two of them are well observed and well within a system where there's some government entity that observes that system. The food scraps and yard debris, the garbage, but then this other bin that has recyclables is really not part of our purview once it leaves the curb. And for those players in the system, a level playing field matters. Very early in these presentations to council, we showed you scary pictures. And they were pictures that showed materials that were collected but not processed. They had been left out in the weather, left out in the elements. There's a public trust where you sort these and you put them out for recycling, but if they sit unmanaged for periods of time, they start to degrade in terms of their value and their usefulness and their recyclability. We talked about showing you, refreshing those scary pictures of a couple years ago, and thought, we don't need to do that. We're trying to bring that industry up to a level playing field where the types of facilities that you visit are not just the best facilities, but sort of model the way all facilities behave. They're not all there yet, but we're hoping that this effort helps get them there.
It really helps people.
If it's helpful in the future, we can always bring those old pictures back, but we just didn't find it necessary.
This is where the photo that I remember, or that actually I've seen it firsthand, is that in, I think it's Hillsborough, where there is this pile of electronics sitting out in the open, just sitting a big pile of them, like a mountain of it, and where it ran on it, and we don't know what happens as a deleting or. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. So we have a couple of questions for you. The first one, I think comments have been provided, but should we go ahead and prepare an ordinance and bring this back to you October 5th for your consideration?
Yes.
Great.
Please.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Is that it? Thank you. Next item is the governance options for the Columbia River levee system.
Oh dear, we have hurricanes, earthquakes, and now we're talking about floods.
Right.
And fire lines.
We had fire.
Fire?
Earlier. Yeah.
Yeah, she made a report on Oxbow. So.
Yes, we have fire too. Wow.
All kinds of questions.
Okay.
Well, I'd just like to frame this, and then I'll pass it back to Scott, Jim, and Andy. First of all, I want to introduce Jim as joining this discussion. Jim's role is to slowly take more responsibility, as Scott is trying to downsize your responsibilities, leading us to your future retirement, so welcome aboard. So, as you remember, I love it because I'm using the same words that staff use now. This, this discussion all got started back in 2005 when Hurricane Katrina, as we are very familiar with hurricanes right now, devastated New Orleans. And what happened, of course, at that time is the levees were breached and there was significant damage and death and scary things happened in the city of New Orleans. And so based on that, after that, is that FEMA got involved in wanting to make sure that all the levee systems in the nation are certified and we can be guaranteed that they are sound and facilities that we can depend on in case there is a natural disaster. So the levee system that we have along the Columbia, goes from Troutdale, and the levee section that we're referring to goes to Sylvie's Island. It has four different organizations that are responsible for that levee system. And so the challenges that we've been facing is, as we get ready to recertify them, and FEMA then allows the companies behind that levee then to continue their development and build new structures when they need it, that permits can be put out to allow more businesses to be placed there, that we need to look at the levee system as a group, as what would be the best governance structure to manage this levee system. And so that is one of the questions that Levee Ready Columbia is trying to answer. And so today, Andy, Jim, Scott are going to be bringing to us a recommendation of what of one option that we might want to consider. So you take it from here.
Thank you, Council President Hughes. Councilors, briefly, here is an opportunity to do a different form of checking the box than I did last week. Last week was substantive agreement. This one's more about making sure you have a smooth handoff in terms of a major project that we're working on. And not to repeat nor to elaborate too much on the Azure Recall, but Azure Recall, we have been working since 2012 in collaboration with another number of entities, and that has included, just as a small subset, Multnomah County, City of Portland, Port of Portland. It's included the cities of Fairview, Troutdale, Gresham, and the Village. It's also included MCDD, who is one of four drainage districts that operates all four. And so it's been a very collaborative experience to date. But we're entering a new phase, and so that's the key. We've been doing the engineering assessment. We have a pretty good sense of what the cost structure is going to look like. There's still some more refinement to that. But we're entering a new phase in which we need to really identify these long-term financing and governance options that are available. And next up then is a discussion October 4th in which some of these governance and preliminary governance work will be discussed publicly amongst the partners for the first time. Since this work does extend beyond my retirement, I want to make sure you have somebody who you can look to continue that with the support of Andy and Jeff.
I
know, and
I'm great.
The good news is it makes you feel really young soon.
Thank you, Greg. The purpose for today really is to determine if Metro Council supports the principles and the direction for the recommendation regarding governance that staff have for you. So we want to test that a little bit. And so with that, I'm going to hand it over to Jim to give you a little bit more detail.
So we have come together under the rubric of something called Levee Ready Columbia. It is leading up to the Oregon Solutions process. And we really have two phases that are going in parallel. The first phase is to really do a technical assessment of the condition of the current flood control system and all of the levees. That work is almost complete and will give us a pretty good sense of where work needs to occur to ensure we can maintain our certification. We don't have a price for that work yet, which brings us to the parallel track that we are working on, which is to develop another subsidiary governance system for how we can ensure in perpetuity that this flood control system is maintained and retains its federal certification and all the benefits that go with that, principally financing and the ability to issue building permits. So what we know about the current system is that it is struggling to develop funds for the capital investments that are likely required to respond to this technical assessment. So we will need some entity or entities to figure out a way to infuse some capital into the system to ensure that it continues to protect these wonderful assets that we have. The other issue is that based on the current way funds are raised within the flood protected area, there is a lot of inefficiency and inequities in those systems. So we're working to figure out if we can fix that. So as Scott and Shirley said, we have a steering committee that Shirley is your representative to that will meet on September 27th. And then principals, 24th?
October 4th.
Well, there's a 27th meeting of staff, is there not?
Right.
Okay. And then the principals meet on the 4th, and they're trying to narrow options for governance. And so if you could think of a giant matrix with lots of different entities and lots of different functions and being able to mix and match that in lots of different ways, what the staff is attempting to do is narrow that so that we can really dig in and do the more detailed legal analysis that's necessary, the economic analysis to determine impacts on revenues and costs for different constituencies. As we worked on this and spent a lot of time with our colleagues on the other agencies and the stakeholders of interest, we've come up with 4 key principles that we think should guide Metro's participation going forward. I'm going to share those with you. The first is that there's an opportunity to eliminate some of the inefficiencies in the system. As Scott mentioned, there are 4 separate drainage districts involved in this. And all of the other agencies that Scott listed have a hand in some of this work. So we see opportunities through this governance track to find some efficiencies and make the system clearer and more efficient. And that's really at the local level, taking those districts and finding a way to consolidate them into something that operates a little more effectively. The second, as I mentioned, there is inequities in the current system. The levies were created around the turn of the century, and were the charges for creating and maintaining them were based on acreage. At the time, people were largely doing farming, and the levies were created to create farmland. You want to talk a little bit about why today it might be a good time to update that system?
Yeah, there's 2 inequities that occur. One is, why would you assess it on the basis of acres in the first place? An acre of farmland is an acre of farmland, but an acre of airport versus an empty lot is the same thing because the acreage is there. And the acreage is not only the basis for the assessment of the in effect, the dues assessment, but also the weighted vote on who gets to vote for the board. So if you have lots of acreage, then you have most of the votes for who sits on the board. The second way of the inequity that comes about is that for 3 out of the 4 districts, which is the lion's share of the area, it's collected as part of the property tax system. So while it's not a property tax, it's incorporated into the compression process. So if an individual property is already compressed, then there's not much of that assessment that's based on acreage in the first place, that's actually collected because of the compression that already exists versus another property that might look exactly the same. It's not compressed, it's paying the full assessment. So there's very different levels of assessment being levied for exactly the same kind of properties up and down the court.
So we have an efficiency opportunity through consolidation, we have an equity opportunity through shifting to a more utility-based rate structure, and then the 3rd principle is that the flood control system right now is only being funded by those people directly protected by the levies. I think we can all agree that looking at Portland International Airport, there is a true regional benefit from the protection provided by the flood system for PDX and some of the other facilities that are behind that flood control system. So we're proposing to you a principle that says a regional contribution towards the solution, ongoing money maintenance and capital, should be tied to the regional benefit created. So looking at PDX, we see that as a really strong basis to make an access for others in the region. We're also fortunate that the port already has a governance district that is designed to collect fees from people based on that benefit. Access for us. So again, we've got consolidation and efficiency, we've got equity, and then we've got a nexus between regional benefit and regional contribution. So those are 3 of our principles. And the last principle is the state and the feds have skin in this game, and we believe they should continue to participate in this work. We are seeking a new start appropriation through the Corps of Engineers. We're also working with the state to look at low-interest financing and other potential opportunities for the state. Andy brings up a great point. In a levee system, there's a levee flood control system, but there's also an entire watershed that drains into that levee. If you could picture the Columbia Sloot watershed essentially functioning as a bathtub, you've got a wall on one side protecting water from coming in, but you also have water flowing downhill. And that water has to be pumped out. And a huge portion of the cost for the ongoing operations of the flood control system involve that pumping. So if we can move to a utility rate structure, we see an opportunity to probably have several tiers, one based on the economic value of the asset protected and the flood control benefit that comes with that, and another related to the costs associated with the contribution of stormwater into our bathtub, which is the Columbia Sloot. So where we stand right now is staff actually met yesterday, and we had a range of options, and we had narrowed it to some degree in a very preliminary way. I think that is the elected officials are the ones who get to take things on and off the table, and Shirley's representative of Fontel. But we've looked at sort of two tiers that the staff thinks are the best. One would involve the Port of Portland sort of being a lead agency and taking over some of these operations. The other would be a City of Portland model. And then there are two other ones that would involve, one would involve Metro and one would involve a more decentralized role for the port. Did I get that right, Andy?
No, the fourth one is a new agency.
New agency.
Legislatively created.
So we'd go down to Salem. All of those are possible. Each one presents various legal and political hurdles. The consensus yesterday was that none of these moves will be necessarily politically easy. The good news is we have the court say that this issue is very important to them, and they see themselves having some authorities that can help solve this problem. And the other good news for the region as a whole is that the City of Portland made it clear that they have so much at stake that if we can't come up with a reasonable solution through this process, they're going to be required to act. The value of the assets and the flood safety and other things that are present there are just too great for the city to let that go. So I think we're starting to see some of the entities stepping up and trying to wrestle this thing to a conclusion. All of these things are probably going to take another couple of years. And again, direction we need from you is, do those principles sound right to guide our role, Councilor Kavanagh's role, President Hughes's role, as these conversations move from a staff posture to a more elected official posture? Again, what we're going to do is narrow, and we'll come back with more details and some of the implications as they develop. Can I ask anything?
Just one thing to point out that's in your staff report, and there's a status report of the various pieces of work going on. There's obviously been the engineering work analyzing the integrity of the facilities themselves, but there's a lot of other pieces. There's an economic profile, what's at stake here, there's an environmental profile, how does the environmental protection interplay with flood protection. There's a risk-based assessment framework so that that can be used to decide what the solutions are, not just what the problems are, et cetera. So that gives you a tabulation of the various pieces of work. There's a climate change piece of work that to understand better how is the flood level going to change over time as we warm and produce more runoff. So that's just the background piece to let you know all the different kinds of work that's going on.
So, Jim, what you're asking from us today is our comments on the governance structure.
Well, I'm really having some principles, right?
Yeah, well,
the structure is fluid enough that I think are you seeing Metro playing a different role than what we've outlined for you, which is we are a property owner, and we are participating both in the collaborative process in our role as convener and regional leader. But we don't see Metro at this point stepping up to take a more leadership role in managing and operating the levy system. We see us cooperating with that and participating as a landowner.
And as I think we were talking about the other day, that as a property owner, we would contribute monetarily based on the value of our property.
Right.
And the value of the property is a regional value, and since we're a regional entity, the region then plays, the taxpayers in the region play a role through us of paying for the value of our property or their property that we manage for them. And ours is not as valuable as an airport, for example.
Priceless, yes.
Yeah, priceless and is historically significant, but not necessarily. In fact, is it insured? Sorry. Carlotta.
Two questions, and both the worksheet, and I thought that when we talked about it before, Multnomah County might be stepping up to play a larger role or be called upon. Has their role been sort of replaced by the City of Portland playing a bigger role? Because I thought when we talked, and I thought that the worksheet or the work session,
the principle that Jim articulated is to shift from an acreage-based, property tax system-based fee collection system to a utility-based system that is tied to the kind of benefit that's realized, impervious surface and value of property being protected. So there's no question amongst the group that the utility-based approach is the preferred-based approach. It's not part of a property tax compression system. It's just like your water bill that you pay separate from your property taxes. how the utility is set up is still in question. It might be that the county is the best vehicle to set up that utility and turn it over to the utility to run everything. They don't think so. The board has articulated that they may have the authority to create a utility and implement that approach. The utility component, there's no doubt, the mechanism to accomplish the utility still is going to take some work, and the county may be involved, may not be involved. Their principal concern is they have 30 years under their belt of dividing the responsibilities between the cities, all the cities, and the county. When the cities do sewer, water, parks, police, fire, all those kinds of services. The county does human services. This is not a human service. So this them getting involved to wholesale take responsibility is a complete reversal of the kind of division responsibilities. The Portland approach that's still on the table, and by necessity is the city of Portland is saying to us, if you don't fix it, we can't stand by and not let it fixed. We will step in and figure out something to fix it. That will entail an interrelationship with the other cities. So in that division of responsibility with the county, it's the cities, but who's going to take the lead? The city of Portland is the one with most at stake and most capability within their departments to do this kind of work.
Well, we have found fairly effective villages, city of Portland not so much.
Right, yeah. And then the second part is, you have not mentioned, we have not talked about BNSF and the role that the railroad has not played. are they not at the table? Are they not in these conversations at all?
They have not been
levied or taxed?
Yeah, as part of this ready levy Columbia process for the last several years, they've kept an arm's length distance from it. We're trying to get them more involved. Historically, on the other hand, like over a long period of time, 50, 60 years, they have been involved. They accepted the generosity of the Corps to repair the Van Vork breach. When it breached in the first place, they accepted additional reinforcements of their berm for levy-related reasons over the years. At this point in time, they said, we don't want to be a levy, but we're trying to get them more engaged. And we don't know what the solution is yet. We don't even have good information on how bad the situation is, because they're not even allowed access to do the same kind of drillings that we've done in the whole rest of the system. So we need the baseline information and then start evaluating what's the right solution. And we need their cooperation just to get that kind of analysis done, much less implement a solution.
Just wanted to tie that in your particular question to the last principle, which is that we need federal involvement, state involvement. Without federal involvement, our ability to do anything substantive with Burlington Northern is very small, to say the least. So we would absolutely need our congressional delegation and certainly the might of the Army Corps of Engineers to be able to do
effectively.
Catherine.
I just wanted to make sure that I was capturing the four proposed principles so I know what I'm agreeing to. Efficient governance, equitable revenue distribution for efficient operations, that's the shifting from the acreage property tax model to a utility rate structure, the regional benefit play that you've got, and state and fed should have involvement or skin in the game.
Correct.
Right, okay.
There's a more articulate description of that.
Where? I missed
under
it.
Page 2 of the staff report. The choices under consideration, infrastructure.
There is like 6 bullets or one,
yeah,
3, 4, 5. So that's why I was like, where are these principles after all? Okay.
So are they not in the worksheet? Because I didn't see the 4 either.
Yeah, I was right there with you.
It was me trying to summarize in my communications director role into 4 bullets rather than 6. So it's my fault.
But it's 6.
Well,
no,
they really roll up into 4.
Yeah.
You can make them 6 if you like. This was me. I can't resist making it.
Can I just simplify?
Surely.
Well, I of course support the principles. I really appreciate the work that you've done to articulate this. Because I know the last thing that I attended, I thought, wow, I don't know how they're going to figure this out because it's pretty complex. So this really helps us to put it in these succinct principles to help guide us. The question I have, though, is about the discussion about governance yesterday when you met. And so I took away that you left the meeting with, there really wasn't any agreement yet, or you're not heading in one specific direction about one agency or another.
It's no, there was a pretty broad-based agreement that the best organization is the port.
Okay.
Now, exactly how and what happens to the districts, do they remain as organizations and get contracted with, or they become a department within the port, you know, lots of those kind of deals. Does the port really have the authority to create a utility fee structure, or do they need to do something to obtain that authority? So there's tons of details, but there's a pretty wide overriding agreement that the port's the vehicle. There's just too much up and down that corridor that's port-related. The airport's being among many things up and down the border that's port-related. The single articulated, and you'll appreciate this, apprehension about the port was from the city of Portland, concerned that they're pretty isolated. They have a governor-appointed board, not a direct-elected board, and so they're kind of isolated from all the rest of us and have some stake in this thing. So that's a concern. On the other hand, the other cities were quite comfortable with their relationship with the port and saw it as a much preferred approach for them as compared to the city of Portland and their historical relationship with the city of Portland. So there was lead preference around the port with recognition that if it doesn't come together, the city has to do something.
Can I just follow up?
Sure.
I'm glad to hear that the drains districts are supportive of this, because that means that things will change for them. And I'm thinking more of the trout mill, and what is it called? The drainage district.
The drainage district boards are meeting right now, having the same kind of conversation. So we don't really know where the drainage districts are going to come down. They need to recognize the benefits of what we're doing, and they're still on the learning curve too.
Okay. Thank you.
Sam? Well, I really appreciate the enthusiasm about the port being a leader here. I think of the assets there that are incredibly important across the board, and then I think about the airport, and you know, that rises way high on the list of priorities. If you think about what is the most important economic asset in our state.
Two airports.
So,
and
Portland International in particular is not just an asset for that. I mean, it's actually one of those assets. It's not just because you're closer to it or in the vicinity of it. It's not more important. I mean, it's just as important to folks living in Wilsonville as it is to people living in Portland. I mean, it's a huge benefit, and really statewide, not just regional. So I support efforts to really help articulate that. I'm not sure if I caught but I'd love to hear a little more about what are Portland's reservations about the port in particular?
Very environmentally related. So in other words, if you're working to restore the Columbia Slough and you're interested in Clean Water Act compliance and endangered species compliance, past relationships with the port have not shown that this is higher priority for the port as it was for the city.
Mm. And are there ways to articulate that? I mean, I guess maybe there are opportunities to try to address that as part of a larger strategy and support Portland in addressing those issues, because those are issues I certainly am concerned about, and a lot of in fact, that's my district, and not that that's the issue, but I understand how important to residents and a lot of lower income residents, that the ones that are still there depend on that safe and clean environment. So I do think that would be an area where maybe we could try to help Portland advance and address those concerns as part of this.
Kevin. Thank you. I just wanted to come back to the reference to the Port of Portland and the board. Yep, they're appointed by the governor, and a lot of folks, or at least in my district, feel like they're They're pretty hidden. They're not really open and transparent. And from my own experience, trying to go and testify before them is very difficult. Very difficult. But then I thought I'd challenge myself a little bit and think about the drainage districts. Yeah, people vote for the members of the drainage district. But are there meetings available? I mean, if people want to find out when the drainage district board meets, do they have websites that announce their meetings like ours? Do they have, our Thursday agenda, we have a citizen comment period. Are they available for that? Okay.
Yeah, I'm not.
They're in effect an operating entity.
Yeah.
Servicing the owners.
Yeah.
Assessed for purposes of maintaining money.
Okay. So is that board elected by somebody, or are they?
The landowners.
The landowners.
The property owners.
You get votes based on your acreage.
Okay.
Your vote?
Is it done in a public election?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. So, as we were bantering about the Port of Portland, it's not like the drainage districts are even more.
Fair concept of democracy.
Well.
And just to clarify, there's a lot of different permutations of the utility and
yeah.
how it's established and governed. So, again,
yeah.
all that is to be determined. You could elect a board, you could have other people elect a board, you could.
Yeah.
So again, lots of room here for this thing to continue to evolve as we work through the steps to narrow those options into something that's workable.
Yeah. Well, and part of the reason why I wanted to go down this path and learn a little bit more from it was, some of the environmental issues that the city of Portland has really dealt with and heard from the public about over the years. We've had the opportunity to hear about that, and there being it, essentially it's been in the public eye, right? And this is a really important program with incredible assets, and I hope that it will be able to be done, move forward with proposals and whatnot in a way that's available to the public. That's all.
Shirley? Well, following up on that, has there been any discussion in your group about looking to the future of how the port board is appointed or is elected? Has that been part of that discussion at all?
There was no discussion about the board appointment itself, but there was discussion about needing some sort of stakeholder group that provides a vehicle for engagement of all the rest of the rest of the interested parties, just like this process has a collaborative process with the interested parties, and they've done that in the past, for example, around the airport master plan and things like that. There's an ongoing citizen engagement committee that advises the port on airport operations that Metro has a seat on, for example. I'm not sure who it is anymore, but I know that it was created. So there's those kinds of stakeholder engagements, but there's not any conversation about the board itself.
I think we're still trying to figure out which entity might be the best one. And then
before you go in that direction, figure out the best one.
Sure.
What is the process? Obviously, the governor appoints the board members. What would have to happen if they change that governance structure at the port? Is that state law? Legislature that would do it?
I'm not deadly sure that this would be an issue that would provoke that,
yeah.
though. I mean, you'd be. And I think one of the principles, as a not a fifth principle, but one of the kind of operative principles that we ought to begin to think about is just to pick the governing structure that is the easiest to put into place and gets put into place the most quickly, that provides for the other four elements in that principles. So part of that might be which, if everything is going to require a lift at the legislature, which requires the least lift at the legislature? And if it's a question of changing the authority of the Port of Portland to add some sort of utility function to them that allows them to collect what is essentially a swim fee, then that, how hard is that to do? Creating a whole new entity, how hard would that be to do? Particularly if all of the people who would be subject to control of the new entity would be essentially in favor of it. And so I think there's a number of ways to look at that, less philosophical and more pragmatic, because I don't want to be on a 5-year plan to implement this and have the 1,000-year flood happen in 2 years. And I say, well, gee, we're still working with the legislature trying to get the governance in place to fix those levies. And I wonder, is any, I mean, sure, the dealing with the railroads is usually a deal breaker just to begin with, because of the nature of the beasts. But do they not acquire some liability if they resist any kind of effort to improve their facility, and their facility therefore collapses and causes a flood that creates property damage? Or would that just be determined to be a
That's a really interesting question that I'm sure we can spend a lot of years arguing.
Sure. Well, and they hire people to like to spend years arguing.
They end up in a long discussion about their view of the world, which is that it's not a levy, and our view of the world would be it is a levy.
Right.
So, long discussion. I did want to circle back just briefly to Jim's point early on that might have just gotten skipped past a bit, which is, we have gone through a really extensive vetting process of the matrix of different organizations, different criteria, included, you know, everything from political risk to operational wherewithal, you know, what would be required for this statement of creation of a utility district and so on and so on. And all that's in there that we've now kind of whittled down to these principles to help guide this next level of decision. But I do want to emphasize this is just sort of the next level, and there's a lot more detail that we get drilled out. But all throughout, the focus has been primarily on exactly what we're talking about, public views, which is, you know, how can you get this done at the end of the day? And if it's such a difficult political lift, or if it's such a difficult political risk on some other front, whether it's a legislature or just amongst jurisdictional partners, that's something we were tending to move away from, not towards.
Right.
There was a discussion yesterday about let's do a 100-year fix of this thing, and let's do it right, and, you know, and other people
that doesn't
involve the legislature no matter what. So, but again, we may find as we look into this, even the board who thinks they may have some authority said it's complicated. So we're going to get a lot of work to do yet to figure out what the path is. And I think it's fair for me to say that none of the entities are leaping at this opportunity. So there's going to continue to be a lot of dialogue and negotiation to try and figure out how we collectively ensure that protection is long-term and rigorous. And
Mother Nature doesn't care.
So, you know, and everybody's got a good reason why somebody's the best or the worst at taking it on, and we're all watching. So,
well, put us on the list. Put us on the list of non-leapers.
Leave it on there.
Yeah.
I think we made some progress yesterday in trying to formulate a response that will work better than one that might have a significant increase in the metro.
Go ahead, Sam.
But I do think it's fair in that context still to look to the port as being a really critical entity in protecting that airport and that asset that is so fundamental to the success of our, no matter what kind of disaster scenario could happen, it would be absolutely critical to look at that and for just the economic long-term development of the region, and it's critical that as we manage our assets that we are, for Metro, I'm certain we agree with being good environmental stewards as we do the work that we do. But I would just, I guess I would, I think that's an important point that should stay in our sort of framework.
Just to underscore that, the last meeting of the execs group in May in the Port of Portland's boardroom, Bill Wyatt said, the Columbia River is high. It's not a flood stage, but it's certainly high in May, water runoff. And if that levee wasn't there, this runway would be under 4 feet of water. people just take it for granted that they work, but Mother Nature gets even in on that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Because someday the water may be 6 feet.
Right. And has been in that.
Yeah. Do you need anything else from us? I heard everybody, I think, say they were
good. Yeah. All right. And we'll take
you
more time. Thank you very much.
Okay. Councilor Communications. Councilor Harrington.
So I'll bring the memo back up since I asked for pause. I've read it. I approve it. Part earlier, post the MPAC, I was remembering two different things. I followed up on construction excise tax, but on the constitutional limitation, the part that I had to be reminded at MPAC, and then again yesterday, was that goes back to that mixing of financing tools and the phrase that gets me anchored every time is the income tax credits and being able to use both of those tools at the same time. So, because that's how these projects happen. So that's how I remember it. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, let's adjourn.